Hello and welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. In studio with me today is USU Extension entomologist Diane Alston. And we're going to talk insects. Now, it's the beginning of a new gardening year. And I've had catalogs just piling up in my mailbox. I got one here at work about herbs. I don't know how they find me here at work, but I'm very grateful for it and a lot to plan for. But I've been looking at the latest editions of Entomology Today, and I just so many fascinating topics just keep popping up. And we talked about this a little more than a month ago. Entomology Today is an online publication, and you can sign up to receive a daily or every other day email that just tells you something fascinating in the world of insects. And I'll put that on the Zesty Garden website so you can sign up for that, or just go to entomologytoday.org. Yes, .org. So. Entomologytoday.org. And in the upper left corner, it says subscribe. So it's that easy.
Yeah,
and one of the first ones is actually one of the later ones that just came out. Spider bites highly unlikely to cause bacterial infections. Now, I keep thinking of the aggressive house spider,
or now called the hobo.
And now
spider.
The hobo spider.
Yeah, well, that's the current name that
and
we're using.
And they, you always heard about how they called caused a necrotic lesion on. Or could cause, right? Yes, on the skin, but now.
Well, and that has that's been debated for quite a while. So actually, this article was very interesting to me because that has been a hotly debated topic, and we get, of course, a lot of questions about concerns for spider bites. And the Utah Plant Pest Diagnostic Clinic, people that have been bitten or have been or have some symptoms that they think might be associated with a bite, and it's still a controversial topic, so to speak. I mean, this particular group, well, in particular, it's one individual at University of California, Riverside. What he did was he went through the literature and just looked at all articles, both popular literature as well as, you know, research literature, articles that referred to spider bites, to symptoms, you know, anything related to that. And what they found was that there really is very little evidence out there in the written form, but you have to, you know, also be aware that maybe not all these things get, you know, written down or published in some way, that there is a, you know, certainly some spiders are poisonous and they can cause certain symptoms and problems in humans and animals that they bite. But to make this association with this necrotic, you know, lesions and kind of sloughing off of tissue and lots of negative things associated with spider bites, that really the evidence really wasn't there for it. There was like one example where a particular spider from Australia had bitten an individual, and then they did get a bacterial infection. And the main way this has been looked at is people have taken spiders and sampled the bacteria on their fangs to see, you know, do these spiders carry bacteria in their fangs? And yes, just like if you sampled our skin, you know, there's lots of bacteria there. So yes, they do find lots of bacteria. But to show that that actually is transferred into a wound and causes some kind of necrotic lesion, that's where there really isn't. There is very little evidence for that in most cases.
Now, can the venom cause the lesion, or has it always been? Now, in this case, it said of 182 Southern California patients presenting with complaint of spider bite, less than 4% had spider envenomation. So I guess what I'm asking is it the venom or is it the bacteria?
So I think when people do, if people know that, you know, see they receive a spider bite, they observe the event happening, and then they have some, you know, symptoms following that, you know, those are going to be in most cases related to the actual venom of the spider that was injected. But in that particular statistic that you just cited, what they were saying is that in most cases, when people had some kind of reaction, they thought they had a spider bite, but they didn't know for sure. That's just the conclusion that they came to or jumped to. And that's what this group of authors is trying to say, is that really in most cases, when people have some kind of a necrotic, you know, lesion or something on their skin, they jump to the conclusion that they've been bitten by a spider, when in most cases they have not.
Now, if you know, if you, let me, okay, let me back up. how do you know you've been even bitten by a spider?
Yeah, and that's tough. And they do mention in this one article about some new techniques to diagnose or confirm that people have been bitten by spiders. And they didn't elaborate on that, so I don't exactly know what those are. I do know when I have been bitten by some of our common spiders around here, not very often, but a couple times. The one that I've been most concerned about in my home is the yellow sac spider. We've talked about that before. And I have been bitten by that. And what you do see are two little, very small puncture wounds.
Do you feel it at the point of?
Yes. To me, the reaction I had to the yellow sac spider bites I've just had two that I can remember, is they were kind of like a little intense mosquito bite. So I got a little red welt, and there was some itching associated with it, you know, the swelling, and I could see the two fang, you know, marks, the two puncture wounds. And so I think that's the most common physical way that we can tell if we've been bitten by a spider, if we don't actually witness it happening. And usually that's not going to be the case. Mm-hmm. You're not going to sit there and let a spider bite you.
Sounds kind of interesting, though.
It does.
I'm sure there are those out there that in fact, I was reading in some of the literature. I can't remember what the insect was that the woman was allowing to bite her, so she
the
could
bed
see.
Bugs. Yeah,
we oh, can the bed bugs.
Yeah, we can talk about. She's feeding them with her blood. But yeah, no. I don't think the case is settled, so to speak. I still think this is going to be a controversial issue, and people are going to be asking the question. But I think what this does point out is that a lot of times when people do get some kind of an infection on their skin, they might, you know, I mean, I can imagine for myself, I would think, well, why do I have this? What caused this? And I might think, well, maybe I was bitten by something. And so I think that's a conclusion that's an easy conclusion to come to when we don't really know. And what this group of authors was trying to say is that based on our data mining, going through all the literature, what we find in most cases is that these people have some necrotic lesions, but there's no proof that they were bitten by a spider. It's just, you know, an injury or something that happened to that spot, and somehow they got a bacterial infection there.
I'm looking at pictures online of the yellow sac spider to see if it's one of the ones that I always pick up with my hand and let outside. It's not.
Yeah,
I'm grateful.
They tend to hang out high, so on the especially where the ceiling and wall meets. That's where I mostly see their little sacs that they make, where they have their
it's
eggs.
It's not a web at all. It's just kind of just this little collection of.
But they will come down the wall. Like we had one in our kitchen area, our dining. Kitchen eating area, breakfast room, that's the right word, when we lived in River Heights, and we even named it Pedro. It was kind of hung out there, and it captured flies that were attracted to the window area, and I didn't disturb it. It was fine. They don't like come after you. They're not aggressive or anything, but a couple times they can get in your clothing and that kind of thing, and that's when you're more predisposed to getting a bite. But I still think I don't want to leave the impression that there are some poisonous spiders out there, and some people are going to respond more strongly to a spider bite than others, just as any kind of foreign invasion of something into our bodies. And so I don't want to say that some people might not have some fairly strong responses to even hobo spiders or yellow sac spider bites, but for the most part, those are not considered poisonous spiders. Most people, 99.9% of people are probably unlikely to have any real severe response. You might have a little, like I said, a mosquito bite kind of, reaction. For most people, that would be it. And that's what the data is suggesting. But I know it's still going to be a controversial topic.
Well, and it sounds like at least it's less than what people would normally think.
Right.
Most likely.
And people say, well, I have this big wound on me. It has to be. It's like, well, maybe it's not a spider bite. Maybe this happened in another way.
I've wondered, every once in a while, I'll wake up in the morning and I'll have an itchy welt. And I just assume, there was a spider in the bed. Because if it was bed bugs, it would continue to get worse, I would think. And so we've never had those. So I'm like, okay, what did I get bitten by in the middle of the night?
And you may have, and that's where I feel like I have been bitten a few times. But look for on the little swollen area, look to see if you can see two little faint, you know, they're not going to be like big gashes or anything. They're going to be very little, tiny, faint little two marks that look like they could be have been fang marks.
Well, and really, to be honest, most spiders don't have mouth parts big enough to even be able to bite you.
That's very true.
And I love going outside and seeing them in the garden anyway. I prefer not to have them in the house mostly, other than the one that we had hanging by the sink, the cat face spider that provided some entertainment and took care of the flies. And I know I can hear people out there in the radios going, how can you let a spider live by your sink? But oh well.
But they are beneficial in that they are eating insects and other things around. And so certainly encourage them to be outdoors. If you don't like them indoors, that's fine. You have that choice to remove them to the outdoors.
But don't squash them. Just get a cup or something and throw them out. But it is really fascinating to watch a spider take an insect or a fly and just wrap it up. It's just, to me, that's just very fascinating.
There was a related story to this that I don't know if you looked at about, there's been this other kind of, a little bit of an urban myth out there about banana spiders. Are you familiar with that, about how there's these lots of large spiders that get transported in banana bunches?
Oh, yeah, I did read that article.
And how people can, you know, freak out about that. And it's true, there are quite a few different tropical spiders. A lot of the, you know, bananas come from Central America and areas where, you know, where they're imported into places like the U.S. for us to consume. And there's quite in fact, I've got a picture of just black and white, but of the range of kind of tropical spiders, and they can be very large and very colorful. And so they do look a little bit scary, or at least very noticeable. But again, the same group of researchers that we were just talking about that looked at this spider bite bacterial infection relationship, they also did a survey of all the spiders that were recovered from banana imports, and they found that again, like 99.9% of them were not poisonous. They are these big, large tropical spiders, can look pretty menacing or intimidating, but they're not going to be biting us or a concern for, you know, for human health. So it was another kind of little urban myth that they were trying to put to rest.
Well, if you'd like to join our conversation, Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, and we'll be in studio for about another 30 minutes. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Okay, so this next one is titled, Scientists Identify Pheromone for Bed Bug Traps. And so this is the woman that we were talking about who allows them to feed on her skin, because apparently she doesn't react to them like most people do.
She's a dedicated scientist, isn't she? She'll offer up her own blood to feed her research organisms.
But it is kind of fascinating if they can come up with a pheromone that will attract them. I mean, that's so much better than spraying a chemical that eventually is just not going to work anymore.
This will be a real game. When this product becomes commercially available and starts getting used, it will be a real game changer for the whole world of bed bug management. And we've talked about bed bugs before on the show, and I think most people are aware through listening to the media about the big elevated concern about bed bugs today, how they've resurged as a major pest or a big pest of concern anyway. I won't say a major pest, not like it's in everybody's house, but a pest of major concern. And one of the main reasons behind that is that they have developed resistance to insecticides that have been used against them, and they're not responding to those. And so we've had to try to develop new ways to deal with them. But knowing that they're there, detecting them is, the first step, and that's been difficult.
And it says that the biggest challenge is dealing with the bed bugs in their early stages.
Right, before you get very many of them and get an infestation that's a lot more difficult to eradicate.
Well, what interested me about this article and also made me grateful for scientists who are patient, and it takes years to develop things like this. I don't have that kind of patience. So I'm very grateful for those that do. So in this case, they were looking for different pheromones, and they thought they found some that would work and it didn't. So they knew they were missing something.
Right. So this, she's a scientist at the Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Regine Grease, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. And so they did. They found through laboratory experiments these some volatile compounds that the bed bugs were giving off. So this pheromone.
How do they measure that? How do they know?
So they use things like gas chromatography and spectrophotometry, those are difficult words to say, to identify chemicals. So they would take the bodies themselves and, you know, scrape off things off the surface, look at their feces, different, you know, components, their shed skins, things like that, and to try to detect all the different chemicals that they could detect coming off of those, and also just off of the any kind of other orifices of the body itself. You know, put a bed bug in a chamber for a while and suck off all the air and then see what kind of chemicals you get, that kind of thing.
So are there chemicals that are not identified? They know they're there, but they don't know what they are. There's like a new discovery?
I suppose that sometimes there can be. I think, you know, I'm not a chemist, but, you know, there's a pretty well-defined, you know, we know what most kind of chemical components are, so we don't necessarily know specific stereoisomers of them and things like that that might exist in nature. But what's really important in insect pheromones is the ratios, the proportions of different compounds together, because most pheromones are made up of alcohol and aldehyde, acetate types of compounds. And so most insect chemical pheromones are actually fairly complex. There may be 5, 6, 7 more different compounds that make up that pheromone. And what's most important is the ratio of those different chemicals to one another. And so typically there are some compounds that are the more dominant. But sometimes if you don't have those minor components also in there, it won't work. It won't attract the insect. And that's what happened in this case and why it took so many years to figure this out. So they ended up finding out there was actually 5 different chemical components that make up the primary bed bug pheromone. And so that was a very important discovery. But then there was another thing that they found out. Do you remember about the histamine? That was the other thing that I thought was so interesting. So histamines are compounds that humans have them too, that we give off when we have like an immune response. So often when we get, if we did get a spider bite or, you know, some kind of an infection or something, our body uses histamines to as part of that immune response. It's also can be used in different kind of physiological events and neurotransmission events. And so they also found that histamines were really important too. And what that did was that arrested or stopped the bed bugs. In fact, they would stop feeding and they would stay still. And so that was a major component of trying to come up with an attractant, something to put in a trap to monitor and or trap control.
So this wasn't with the original pheromones.
Right.
They just discovered that
right.
If they added this to it,
right,
this is what would happen.
It was also, they found that the histamines were very important. So I thought that was kind of a very novel and...
How did they just stumble across that? They just keep trying different things?
So yeah, I was trying to remember about the
histamines. I mean, she endured 180,000 bed bug bites in order to feed their large bed bug colony required for the research. I just like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah. So it just said they were chemicals that were isolated from the shed bed bug skin. So when they molt to grow in size, they shed off their outer exoskeleton. And so they were looking for chemicals associated with those shed skins. And they found that this,
meaning they don't feed while they're shedding the skin. And so that's where they got the histamine.
Well, and just that it was associated with their exoskeleton.
Okay.
So in other words, they're carrying it around on their bodies. And so what they feel its a role is that when bed bugs, it helps them detect other bed bugs. So if a bed bug detects this histamine at very low levels, they'll know that there's other bed bugs in the area. And that would tell them that there's probably could be a host present or at least a place that's protected. So they'll tend to stop, arrest their feeding, and stay put. Mm. And so that was the other important component. So the pheromones, what it's doing is drawing them in, so attracting them, saying, come here, there's other bed bugs or there's a food source or whatever. And then when they also detect the histamine, it says, okay, now stay put. And so those were the factors together, these five different volatile chemicals plus the histamine that they found made the really super duper effective attractant for bed bugs. And so they're interested in using it both as a monitoring tool and as a, you know, for control tool.
And the article says neither the histamine alone nor in combination with the previously identified pheromone components effectively attracted and trapped bed bugs in apartments, so they had to keep looking. Mm-hmm. 35 experiments later, they found three new volatiles that had never been reported before.
Right.
And putting those in there,
right,
all of a sudden, bingo.
Right.
Now, that's got to be quite a eureka moment.
Oh, definitely. And like you say, it doesn't come overnight. A lot of times when we, in movies and things, you know, when they depict science on TV, they show it as if it happens like overnight. But as you mentioned, this researcher worked for years and fed many bed bugs her own blood to get to this. So she was a...
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we appreciate it. So this will be, I think, a real game changer because there has not yet been an effective bed bug monitoring tool. It's always been just going in and searching and looking in places where we know they tend to hide. And we've also been using dogs. We've talked about that before, too. Dogs that can detect the scent of... You train them to detect the scent of the bed bugs and they can indicate that there's bed bugs in a particular facility. And I think that will continue to be important. But these traps and can be a thing you can put in place and leave them for a period of time.
And they're not going to hurt you.
And they're not going to hurt you. So they're something that we can put into, especially like in public housing and places, large apartment complexes, things where the bed bugs have been particularly difficult to eradicate.
Now, let me ask, how long does it usually take from the point of eureka to having a product
Can be used? They mentioned in this particular article that they're already working with a Canadian-based company, Contech Enterprises, who I know of because I've used some of their other insect pheromone compounds, to develop an affordable bait and trap. And so I would think this should be out on the market, you know, something. And it will continue to be improved and, you know, I'm sure improved upon over the coming years. But I bet there will be something available within the next year.
Where did they get the chemicals then? Are they not going to scrape off a lot of little bed bugs?
So that's
a
good point.
Are they synthesizing?
Right. So that's the neat thing about once we identify what compounds are in insect pheromones or the ones that we know we need to use in the product to make it attractant to work, is we can then just synthesize them in the lab and we don't have to, you know, extract them from the insects and try and grow large numbers of the insects to be able to get the compounds.
Now, another question in my mind about this is, okay, so they just, it arrests their feeding, they just stop. But it's going to take a while for them to actually die because they're not feeding anymore. Because some of them,
they can live
more than a month.
Yeah.
Oh, years?
I think they can even live a year. They can go, depending on what life stage they're at. I think adults can live long periods of time without feeding.
So you're going to have this in the home for quite a while.
Yes, but if like these public housing or large apartment complexes where they've been particularly difficult to eradicate, you know, if you have these kinds of traps just out, you know, whatever density of them you need to be effective, you know, one per apartment or one per room in an apartment, and just have them there all the time, I would think that
keeps them
from building up. Mm. Yep.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, is in studio with me for about another 15 minutes. Join our conversation with your question or comment. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. We'll take any insect question, 800-826-1495. Or send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of the Zesty Garden today. Diane Alston, USU Extension Entomologist, is my guest. And we were just talking about the next topic during the break. And it's just utterly fascinating to me. So the title of this is Flowers Trick Kleptoparasitic Flies into Pollinating Them. So kleptoparasitic is telling me that, okay, this is a fly that steals from something else.
Right. So it's a thief. And so this group of flies, their family name is chloropids, their behaviors are that they steal, actually, they feed on insect hemolymph, and hemolymph is the blood, basically, of insects, of certain group of insects called myriids, plant bugs. And but they don't have a way to access that themselves from the bug. They can't go up to it and get to the hemolymph. So they have to wait until there's a predator already attacking that plant bug, so that it's, you know, sticking its mouth parts into it or whatever and making available the hemolymph coming out, and then the fly.
So it's a scavenger?
It's basically a scavenger, yeah. Mm. So it's coming
it's
in.
Getting
and
the roadkill.
Exactly, that's what it is. But then we were talking over the break about, isn't this amazing that then this plant has evolved to mimic the odor that's given off by this plant bug hemolymph to trick this fly, this kleptoparasitic fly, into coming to the flower of the plant and then would be pollinating it.
So it comes into the flower, it's trying to find that insect, and in so doing it ends up pollinating the flower before it flies out and going, oh, that was a dud.
Right. And so this flower or this plant is actually unlike the bee, typical kind of bee pollination that we're more familiar with, where the bee does get something out of visiting the flower. It can get nectar, it can get pollen, and sometimes other resources as well. But in this case, the plant is totally tricking the fly because it's not actually offering it any resources that the fly needs to survive. It just wants it to come and pollinate it. And so typically, odors that are attracted to flies are kind of smelly things that we would consider not so fragrant or pretty, like the bee pollinated types of flowers. So something that kind of smells a little off to us. And that's what this
rotting flesh
kind of thing. And so this myriad, this plant bug hemolymph has kind of a little bit of a nasty odor, but that's what the fly is attracted to.
I found that this statistic is quite telling. 4 to 6% of all flowering plants are pollinated based on deceit.
Yeah.
That's quite a high number.
It is quite a high number. I didn't realize it was that high either.
So so where would you find this type of a fly?
Well, these flies have a fairly broad distribution. They're not particularly super common, but they are occurring, you know, worldwide or in many places of the world. This particular plant that they focused on in this research study, its common name is called smearwort, which isn't a very appealing name either, but it says it's native to Southern Europe. But there are certainly representatives of the same family of plants that do occur in North America. And so I assume they have the same, they're also fly pollinated and have a similar kind of odor and a way to trick the flies into coming in.
Just looking online at the picture
is pretty impressive. Yeah. So the one on this particular article has a large assassin bug, which is a predatory insect, has a big beak-like mouth part that it's poked into this plant bug that it's feeding on. And then it shows this little chloropid fly that's come along on the, you know, and hanging off on the outside, taking advantage, coming in to suck up the extra hemolymph
that's
coming out. There's
three of them. I can count one, two on the assassin bug, and it looks like one's sitting on top of the
plant bug. Yeah, so it's pretty amazing that all these kinds of things go on in nature, and in many cases we're not even aware that it's going on.
Well, it's just amazing what nature does to develop this kind of a relationship, because any one in here, if it doesn't happen, then the rest of them all suffer.
Right, exactly. And this particular article didn't go into depth about this plant, this smearwort, about what kinds of flowers it has. But in general, the plants that rely on flies for pollination often have a fairly small, not showy flowers, and so they are conducive to like a smaller insect being able to get in there and move the pollen around versus a larger showy flower like we tend to think of with bees, or certainly hummingbirds, even larger.
Hmm. Well, our next topic is ant larvae cannibalize eggs in their own colonies.
Yeah.
Not something I was familiar with before. what purpose could that serve?
So have you heard of the general concept of what's called kin selection? This is where it's been shown in, you know, all kinds of animals, including humans, that there's many different ways we can exhibit kin selection. But one of the most common is that we tend to favor other individuals that we're more closely related to. And so things that are in your family, other animals that are related to you that are in your family are going to be more important to you in your survival, likely, than ones that are more distantly related to you. And so that's what this kind of all comes down to. And I really hadn't thought much about, I knew that ant colonies are very complex, but really hadn't thought much about before reading this article that actually even the larvae, so the little, you know, grub-like ants before they become adult ants, actually can take action on others in their colony. In this case, they're eating or killing eggs of other ants in their colony. Say, well, why would they do that? And this study found that they will pick on eggs that are not closely related to them. So what they're trying to do is select for the ones that will survive, the ones that aren't harmed, those that are more closely related. So you know, your family does better than other more distant related individuals in the colony.
Well, what I'm a little confused about is, isn't they all have the same mother? It's one queen, isn't there, in the nest?
Well, there's various kinds of reproduction, and they're not always from one single mother.
Okay.
So, and they also showed that males, male larvae, ant larvae, were more likely to kill eggs in the colony than were females. And so, and that's been shown in other kinds of insects too, and I think other kinds of animals as well, that kin selection is maybe exhibit a little bit differently between the genders. And, you know, why that is, I'm not a specialist in that area, but things I could think about is that males view it more as a food source and, you know, I'm going to do better if I eat more or I, you know, consume more nutrients, whereas females that are related to other individuals might think of it more in a nurturing way, that we want these individuals to help support our colony, and because I'm going to be a forager and I'm going to be out there, you know, finding food for my colony, so I want, you know, more individuals to help me do that, whereas males are more focused on just, you know, reproduction.
To the human eye, these larvae all look the same. So, and the eggs all look the same.
Yes,
so how do the ants know which ones are of their kin and, right, and others that are not?
So it kind of comes back to some of the topics we were talking about in the last article about odors. So odors, smells, chemicals are very, very important in insect communication. And that's actually, you know, pheromones play a big role in social insect colony organization. Now, who's going to be a worker, who's going to be a soldier, who's going to, you know, have different roles in the colony. And so it's all done by chemical odors. And so that's how they can detect as well, by basically kind of tasting the chemicals that are on the surface of these eggs and being able to tell whether they're more like their own compounds or more different.
Well, we've got a number of topics, and we're going to move right along. Probably won't be able to get to everything today. The next one is baby bird mimics and moves like a caterpillar.
Did you watch the video?
I did. I watched the video, and I thought, that's just crazy.
Isn't that amazing?
That just was really amazing to me. So why?
So this is a lowland Amazonian bird. So it lives in river forested areas, and the adult is, so what was the common name of the bird? It was Cinereus mourner, that kind of a weird name. And the adults are just this very drab gray. It's kind of a small bird. And so I assume that the adults are drab color because they're trying to hide in the forest, and that protects them from predators. However, their baby birds for about the first 20 days look very, very different from the adults. They're small, but they are bright red, and they have these feathers that make them look like the kind of the undulating motion of a caterpillar when it moves. And when you watch the video, the bird... the way it moves its neck, it mm-hmm. looks just like a caterpillar. So why would it choose to have bright colors? Well, what it's actually doing is called aposematic coloration. And so there are caterpillars in the Amazonian forest, as well as, you know, here in North America too, that you've seen, like monarch caterpillars are very brightly colored. And the reason for that is to try to tell potential predators, that I have not toxic chemicals in me, and so you don't want to eat me because I'm going to make you sick. And so that's why those bright colors are used as flags, as warnings. And so that's what this baby bird has done, is mimicked aposematic, so toxic caterpillars that are in the Amazonian forest, to protect itself from other birds, snakes. I don't know what
it gets a little bit older, can fend for itself.
Right,
a bit more.
Exactly. So instead of, for whatever reason, we don't know why, it evolved that kind of pathway versus being a drab, hidden, you know, kind of baby in the nest, because it's low in the forest floor. So I guess there's lots of potential predators that can access it. It's gone this other way of being very brightly colored, having these movements that make it look like it's a caterpillar, and basically scare away predators from eating it.
So... which was the first bird that decided, okay, if I start moving my head like this, this is going to happen. So I'm assuming this is natural selection.
It is.
And it's just little bit by little bit, nature selects out those
that do the best.
That do the best with this.
Right.
And then it just got to this point where it's like, wow, that's exactly like the caterpillar.
And these researchers did survey in this area where the bird lives and found, I don't remember if they said one or more different species of caterpillar that this baby bird really looks a lot like. So they do know that is this what's called Batesian mimicry. So Batesian was named for an early ecologist that showed that certain animals will mimic colors and actions of others to protect themselves, even though they themselves are not toxic.
So in the next 5 minutes or so, I want to make sure I ask, so why Latin?
Oh, okay.
Why is Latin used to identify animals?
Okay, so it's a good question, because a lot of people say, well, these horrible, complex scientific names, why do we use them based on this dead language? It's no longer around. Well, the reason it was selected on this particular article is called Curious Scientific Names Can Make Insects Famous. It points out two main reasons. And one of those is that the language itself, Latin, is a dead language, a dead tongue. People don't speak it. And so it's not continuing to evolve. And so basically the form of Latin that we have today is the same form of Latin that we had a while ago and will have into the future. And so that's actually advantageous, because then you're not changing words all the time and changing the way the language and how what you say. And there was another reason too. It's that it's a natural, because no one does speak it, then it won't, like one country or group of people that speak the language won't try to take ownership, and it's not giving more, you know, due prestige to one group, one language than another, because Latin is kind of a universal language used across the world, but it's no longer actually being used in the spoken language. So those were the reasons why Latin.
But I do see the language itself is not used consistently. I mean, sometimes it's named after the location. Sometimes named after the scientist that discovered it. And sometimes it's just named after a fictional character. I mean, this just makes me laugh. I'll bet you can't guess who this is named after. Spongiforma squarepantsii.
Yeah, right. Isn't that cute?
SpongeBob.
So what it all comes down to is taxonomists. We might think of them as these boring scientists, but they actually are, you know, they have a sense of humor and they want to have fun. So this is all about taxonomists having fun. But this is a bit controversial. I mean, it's mentioned slightly in the article, but I know from being in a science where we use taxonomy, Latin names, is that some traditional taxonomists would rather stick with naming organisms for their appearance. So if they're green or have long antennae or black or whatever, and that's been more the traditional way, using Latin names that reflect their physical appearance.
But if you name it after a scientist, that doesn't really tell you
much about its
much
appearance.
About it.
But you have to admit, when there's too many insects that are all named black something or green something, it does get a bit monotonous, and also can be confusing, because there's two similar in name.
There's Tinkerbell and Nana. And then there's also a horsefly named after Beyonce.
Yes. So some people just take license, so to speak.
I wonder how Beyonce feels about that.
A horsefly. But it's all about having fun, I think. But it is controversial because some taxonomists don't think we should be naming them after, you know, fictional characters or movie stars or something.
But that is interesting to know that, okay, well, Latin, it's a dead language. It's not changing. So that's the basis for doing that.
And that's across all organisms. It's, you know, plants, animals, fungi, bacteria. We use the Latin names.
Well, Diane, we've reached the end of our time.
Well, we talked about a lot of topics.
It's been fascinating. We'll be doing this again.
All right.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. And Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. Coming up next is Nancy Williams, and she's a Providence resident, a journalist, a good friend of mine, and she'll be introducing the next segment of Petals and Prose.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams here for Petals and Prose, and today I want to share from another of my favorite books that I don't think I have shared with you before. It was a lovely gift to me like 26 years ago, so I hope it's still in print. But if not, you can probably get a used copy of it, and it's totally worth it. It's called Cultivating Sacred Space, Gardening for the Soul, and it is written by a photographer and gardener whose name is Elizabeth Murray, and she has... she's the author of the bestseller Monet's Passion, Ideas, Inspiration, and Insight from the Painter's Gardens, as well as several more. She lives in Northern California and is an active garden designer, also a lecturer, photographer, and painter. And in this little part of her book, she is interviewing people with fabulous gardens. She's written about Monet's garden. Of course, we all hear about that as an example of fabulous gardens. But these are two regular, ordinary people who have designed amazing gardens themselves. The first one I'm going to read you about is Rebecca Dye and her husband, Hank Hellbush, in their gardens in Brookdale, California. She writes, "Rebecca Dye and her husband, Hank Hellbush, raise three children together and run a well-respected landscape architectural design firm. They both share a great love of one another, of family, of nature, and of community. Their passionate love and enthusiasm is integrated with nature into their personal lifestyle and their family values and how they run their business. We had a discussion about the natural gardens and environment that they helped create and how we can bring vitality back into our lives. Hank said, I think we ought to redefine what our quality of life is. It's not what we're told through the media to buy. It's being aware of what's around us. Rebecca says, the ideal place where many people want to live is where it's natural and wild and not all perfect and managed. They want to live in these naturally beautiful places. But when they go there, what do? They put in a lawn and a lot of little round hedges and shrubs. They want to be a part of it, but it's like they don't know how. So they keep nature at a distance. It's a view, not a part of their life. Hank and Rebecca's philosophy of creating their natural garden is more than a way to bring people back to the reality and beauty of the earth. For their own enrichment, it's also about helping the earth and all its creatures survive and thrive. Says Hank, Sarah Stein, who wrote a book called My Weeds, realized after making an exquisite kitchen garden with parts that she'd excluded all of the animals. The animals had all left, even the painted lady butterflies. She began to do a lot of research, and she wrote her second book, Noah's Garden, that's like the cookbook of the world ecology. She had the insight to take information from all different disciplines and put them together. She looked at why birds migrate at a certain time of year, and the connection of why some berries that the birds eat are ripe at the same time. There are all these different relationships that she saw. What I've realized is that we must preserve the diversity of species in the environment we live in, our own gardens. It doesn't work to create these new villages, developments, with the 10 best plants, meaning that they have no pests, diseases, or animals, and then go to Yosemite for nature. We can't have this preserved open space and then these cities that are dead. We have to have a new vision about living within our environment. So what we need to do to preserve the species that are indigenous. I've done a bit of research on butterflies. They're very specific with host larval food. No matter how many butterfly bushes you plant, you're not going to get any painted ladies unless you have mallows for their larvae to eat. They aren't going to breed there, so they won't be preserved without plant and habitat diversity. By reintroducing or allowing the native plant species to come back, the animals are coming back too, because then we're creating a sustainable environment. It's not sustainable if the pieces aren't there. Hank and Rebecca's philosophy is to embrace and enable nature to bring her gifts back to the land. In their own personal garden, in a redwood forest that used to be an old camp for people to visit for the summer, a lot of invasive plants were planted, such as periwinkle vines and ivy as ground covers, which choked out delicate natives. So they removed the invasives and opened the soil up for nature to come back in, for birds to plant the native seeds, for the seeds to find where they're best situated, to find where the water flows freely. Their creek floods and changes from one winter to the next, creating different little sandy banks where a rock or a log may have lodged, causing the water to change course. Rebecca explains some more of their philosophy. The native grasses like fescue just started arriving. They shimmer in the light. So many birds have come since we took out the invasives. Native orange tiger lilies have been arriving. We've had to have patience because the first year it was pretty bare. Our hillside had an acre and a half of ivy growing on it. When we removed it, the wild seeds started germinating, and it was like, who's going to show up? Who's coming? They have helped their clients bring nature back into their more mundane environments. So instead of just having a suburban kind of landscape or plain green lawn, they have called nature back and given it the place. A rock farmer that they work with goes up to the landfill full of huge boulders owned by cattle ranchers who want some of them removed. The rock farmer carefully takes out some of the lichen-covered rocks and brings them down to Rebecca and Hank's garden. I ask Rebecca how she plants her stones, those great boulders that they use in their landscaping projects. Says Rebecca, first, I have a general idea of the sizes and types of stone and the general locations where I want them in a particular garden. I make a list, like 1 3-ton bird bath-shaped stone in an animal stone, or a 4-ton one with a low profile, and then the rocks just come. I figure whichever rocks want to come will come. I wait and see who comes. I don't pick them out. I send the list to the rock farmer, and the rocks come on huge flatbed trucks with moss and lichens and wildflowers. We handle them very gently, not to scratch them. We sometimes have to go under electrical wires and through tree branches with big cranes. The scale and the size are huge. Certain rocks, when they arrive, you see families. Sunny lichens, blue-green lichens, beautiful colors, ones with moss-green colors, and which ones probably come together. And you just know which ones want to be together, so then you think of them in relationships. They place the rocks as though planting trees in permanent places where the stones will live and grow. They want them to feel happy and natural there. They might put two rocks next to each other like kissing rocks and welcome the moss to grow on them. Rebecca says, you do it like flower arranging. I start with the biggest ones and any major ones that I know where I want to put them. Then all of the others display themselves in relationship. I don't try to figure it out ahead anymore. I'm always so delighted to see what arrives. We welcome them. Something that is really strange is that the rocks pull so much energy, and particularly on a sloping site where a new house has been put in and there's not enough room for the energy to settle out. The energy runs down the hill. The rocks provide that power to stabilize the energy that had dissipated off the site, even when they first arrive before they're set. The whole energy of the property changes. Everyone notices it. We all get incredibly thirsty. We have to drink lots of water all day. There seems to be a biological link with people, because even my monthly cycle will come whenever I set rocks. It's a natural biological connection, and we all feel how the energy changes instantly. When the rocks are unloaded, everyone talks softly. It's like a presence has arrived. One of the most remarkable things Rebecca and Hank have created is an incredible stream. They placed rocks of all different sizes and shapes in a pattern to be beautiful and natural, but also to create a variety of gurgling sounds. Different kinds of drops of water and changing movement, and then the stream was invited to run through the path created by the rocks. Rebecca says, "It sounds like when you're up in the Sierras. There are shallow, wide washes with lots of little sounds and big spills and loud splashes. When you walk along it, all the sounds change. In the summertime, when the banks are higher, it's completely different than when the banks are more filled with water." Hank says, "It's fun to move the boulders around, and we see how this changes the creek. It's the hydrology of the creek. Certain slopes make the water dig down underneath. It changes the sound and the water patterns. It's all energy." All of a sudden, this landscape that would have been like a golf course lawn was now alive, and crawfish, frogs, and fish came within days, sensing this was a place for them. A great blue heron flew in, and there is now singing and new life and babies, inviting nature back into these areas that were man-made, desolate places, and it renews the sound of the land, as well as the soul of the people now on it. Hank and Rebecca's partnership is in life and in nature. It began with wonder, and it's wonder that drives them now to create and share and believe. This is a reading from Cultivating Sacred Space, Gardening for the Soul by Elizabeth Murray. I hope you can find this book somewhere because it is really a treasure, and I'll be reading more of it later on. I'm Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden. I'll see you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earl. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.